Good morning, everybody. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more at WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. It's also good to be back with you all. I was out this last week with my family, which was a good week to have with all of them. My youngest daughter in town and then my nephew back from the Peace Corps. So we had a good week, and now it's back on the air with my other family here in the world of radio on WEAA. So we are going to start looking this morning at the trial of Cesar Goodson that is taking place today. Today, the closing arguments will be laid out by both the prosecution and the defense, which means the judge, either late this afternoon or first thing in the morning, will go into his own deliberations to make his decision about what this means. And to me, the Cesar Goodson trial raises so many questions for us to wrestle with. I mean, there is a strong possibility that as the law stands now, these officers cannot be and won't be convicted of the crimes that they have been charged with by the state's attorney's office. Mm-hmm. But what does that say to us about our system of public safety and justice and how we define what those words and ideas mean and the concepts mean and the reality means? It also shows a divide, really, I think for the first time in my covering this over the last 23 years, of a distinct divide between police and prosecutors, as really never seen before, and the way they've conducted the work. You saw it, the way it exploded inside the trial itself. Mm-hmm. And, of course, for years when officers were charged of a wrongdoing, it was usually an internal affair inside the police department that decided which way to go, the prosecutors acquiescing usually to what the police wanted to do. Mm-hmm. This time, the state attorney decided to prosecute the cases without that investigation going forth inside the police department, but independently. And that, I think, raised, and you saw in the battles last week in the court, what the controversies that were raised between those two bodies. So let's wrestle with that and have your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages. But I would love to hear your thoughts on all those issues, the community aspect of it, where we go from here and what this says to the community, and also where this goes legally. And speaking of legally, Stephen Levin's in the studio. He's a former prosecutor and a partner at Levin and Curlett, and a former federal prosecutor. Should be very clear about that. Good to see you, Stephen. Welcome.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you.
Tarek Touray is with us in studio, writer, poet, activist. His new book is Black Seeds, The Poetry and Reflections of Tarek Touray. Good to have you in the studio, Tarek.
Thanks, Mark.
And joining us, co-hosting and working this day, is Kalima Young, instructor at Taos University and the University of Maryland College Park, a teacher and an activist and thinker and artist and more. And Kalima, good to have you in the house.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
410-319-8888. So, Stephen, let me start by just asking this, the legal question. I mean, about what's happening in this court. I mean, what really struck me, and I think struck a lot of people, was this animosity, it seemed, between the police who were on the witness stand and the prosecutors, the contradictions that the police said, contradictions in terms of how the medical examiner testified earlier and being contradicted by what the police officer said. What the police officer said who was investigating the case. So what does all that say to you as a former prosecutor?
Sure. Well, when I was a prosecutor, I worked hand in hand with my agents, and even now, if you go and observe a case in federal court, you'll certainly see prosecutors and law enforcement officials working together to convict someone accused of crimes. I think what we saw last week is a sad commentary on the state of affairs as it is currently with the state's attorney's office's relationship with local law enforcement. It shouldn't be that way. We should have the men and women in uniform working together with prosecutors, and each should be listening to the other. And clearly what we heard last week was that the prosecutors were not listening to Investigator Young when she testified, Investigator Taylor, when she testified that she presented information to Janet Bledsoe, and Bledsoe just stormed away and didn't want to look at it. That's really outrageous, and you don't want prosecutors ignoring evidence, no matter who's on trial, whether it's a police officer or a civilian.
So what evidence did you think they ignored?
Well, I think that she tried to show notes of the medical examiner's initial statement, apparently, that Mr. Gray died as a result of a freakish accident, quote, unquote. And Ms. Bledsoe apparently had no interest in reviewing those notes, and according to the evidence, she pushed them away. Ms. Bledsoe pushed those notes away.
Before we turn to the two guests, but those were in direct contradiction to what the medical examiner herself said in court and what the state's attorney says that the medical examiner said.
Well, of course, right? What the state's attorney says in court is not evidence. So there were allegations made by the deputy state's attorney, but that's not evidence. So the only evidence before Judge Williams is the fact that the medical examiner initially said it was a freakish accident, and then you have the medical examiner denying, at least initially when she was on the witness stand,
right,
denying ever having said the word accident. And now we have evidence that maybe that wasn't accurate.
Evidence, because that's what Bledsoe said. I mean,
the lead investigator. Correct.
Right. So there's a contradiction there between what the examiner said actually happened and the lead police investigator said happened.
Correct. And that's a huge issue. It's not so much that a medical examiner can't form a different opinion later on. It would have been absolutely fine. I don't think anyone would take issue with a medical examiner's initial finding that it was an accident and then later determining it was a homicide, which, of course, carries no legal significance. It's really a medical significance. But the fact that the medical examiner denied ever having said it was an accident raises, I think, deep concerns with anybody watching the trial, because it goes directly to the credibility of the government's case.
So as non-legal observers, I mean, when you read what goes on this, I mean, what does it say? I mean, especially, Tarek, I know that you've been deeply involved in community activities and dealing with Black Lives Matter and other issues in our community, as well as kind of response with this trial. I mean, what does all this say to you?
I think it's as muddy as it looks, muddy as it seems, to know they were going back and forth in the manner that Scott was just mentioning. It deepens the distrust that, you know, not only the community has here in Baltimore, but I think all over. The case of the six officers that have been charged with, you know, the negligent murder of Freddie Gray, is something that people around the United States are watching. And to know that they spent, I believe it was Thursday, Baynard Woods, journalist for The Guardian, said
right,
paper, even reading some of his tweets and some of his comments just about how messy it was in the courtroom and everything that happened with mm-hmm. Bledsoe. I know for myself, as somebody who isn't the fondest friend of our legal system, it just deepens the distrust. It makes you feel like, hey, man, these people don't even know what they're doing. And I think that for any profession, if you look and you say, hey, Mark's in there arguing with whoever it is he's on the radio with, and it's sloppy, and knowing that two people have already walked, knowing that there was an impassioned speech in front of City Hall, I believe, or in front of the courthouse steps.
State's attorney?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, saying that they will be charged, and everybody was up, you know, pretty much in an uproar because all the jubilation around, hey, we finally may be able to see some sliver of justice. To know that now we're three prosecutions in, and it's just getting messier as they go along, as the trial goes along. So we really had to take a step back and, you know, really see what we were asking for and what do we really expect now, you know, to know. So, you know, back to my first point, distrust.
Yeah, no, I second that. I think, you know, riding the wave of protest, the wave of, okay, we've got to do something, and having that moment of, oh, wow, are these officers actually going to be held accountable after several instances where they were not? People were really excited about it, but there's always that level of the excitement about feeling like you're going to have justice and the actual harsh reality of proving what would be just. And I think, to me, it speaks to a need to truly understand and define, as activists and as community members, what justice looks like and what people are actually fighting for. If it also speaks more to the systemic need of more community involvement with the police and monitoring the police and holding people accountable on a day-to-day basis, so that there is some level of clarity if ever there's going to be clarity in a very muddy water that is Baltimore all the time.
Mark, if I could jump in, I think everybody here in your studio and your listeners would no doubt agree that police should be held responsible for their misconduct. No question about that. But each case has to be looked at individually. And so I have certainly seen police engage in misconduct, and so you make a motion to suppress or you prosecute them when it's appropriate. Just like there are bad lawyers, bad doctors, there are bad police officers, and even police officers would tell you that. But you don't hold necessarily these six officers responsible for the misconduct of others. And I think that's the feeling that people are starting to get, that these charges were brought because there is a history of misconduct by a segment of law enforcement. But you don't prosecute innocent people for the crimes of others.
So I'm going to look at that in this broader sense in a second, and what you just said, Stephen. I was thinking about two quotes here. I mean, Warren Brown, who's a defense attorney, and no other defense attorney in town, has stated that he, in the press, that he thought that the state's attorney indicted these officers without first going through the evidence, understanding it was there to build a case, but did it backwards, which is why their case is so weak. That's Warren's argument.
Mm-hmm.
And then contradiction to what my friend, Doug Colbert, who's been on the show many times, the University of Maryland School of Law, said, when he was quoted in the paper saying the usual way the police and unions But in the Sun papers, the usual way the police and unions are accustomed to is to do their investigation, to recommend that no charges are filed, and for the state's attorneys to follow. Not in this case, though. The prosecution is saying when you leave somebody unprotected in a very unsafe situation, that may indeed represent a depraved indifference. Taking up that was most of his quote. But so to me, there's real contradictions here, and maybe the contradictions are that both have validity. Both what Doug was saying about how things usually happen and how they were done in this case, and maybe what Warren Brown was saying in his experience as a defense attorney also has some merit in how the cases were brought. I mean, to me, these two contradictions are really glaring, that we don't usually bring indictments against officers for harming or incorrectly arresting somebody, especially in a black community, but that the way these cases were brought were not necessarily the strongest cases.
Mark, I don't think they're contradictions. I think in a particular case, you could have a situation where the depraved heart murder charge is correct. If, in fact, there was evidence of a rough ride, then the murder charge would have been appropriate, arguably. But there was no evidence of it. So that's where we go to Warren Brown's statement, which a lot of us have said who have been observing some of these trials. There was no evidence of a rough ride. In fact, the state's own expert suggested that, well, he certainly testified. He didn't see evidence of a rough ride. And so that is a case where Ms. Mosby was led by her constituents rather than the evidence. And had she actually looked at the evidence, there's no question in my mind she never would have brought that charge, and she may not have brought any of these charges.
I think to put it plainly, like context doesn't really provide a conviction. If that makes sense to me, because you're looking in the context of rough rides, and I think Thursday, or was that Wednesday or Thursday, that whole theory was kind of refuted of a rough ride, because they couldn't even define exactly what a rough ride was, and if you saw it on camera, is that exactly what it is? Because it's something that's a practice that's been built into the culture of policing in Baltimore, where people may discuss it. It's almost the same way as knockers or unmarked police. We know knockers beat people up on the regular. But at the same time, if you were to bring that to court and say, well, how does it happen? What, you know, they take you in the alley, or how does that actually play out? You couldn't really define it. You would just say, hey, man, they kicked me, or they did whatever they did. And I think what Warren Brown is saying is that, you know, and Scott were talking about it before we came
Stephen,
in.
Right.
I'm Stephen. You have to be thorough. And if anybody needs to be thorough, it has to be the state's attorney's office. So to not take that time, it makes the prosecution or the initial indictment look like in the heat of the moment. We know we have all this uprising going on outside. we need to do something. And I think that hurried approach to it has kind of caused the prosecution's case to unravel. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing now day by day. And especially, like I said, on Thursday was kind of like the hallmark or pinnacle of that happening, because emotions are flaring, because both sides are sloppy in a way.
Well, no, I think I definitely agree with both positions. It was hastily brought to bear without looking at the evidence, and this is what's going to happen, as opposed to us really, I think, from an activist perspective, querying exactly all of the rules and the environment and the situation at hand that occurred to even put Freddie Gray in the position that he was actually accosted in the first place. And I think that is the conversation that needs to continue to be had.
Because, and open the phones here, because what you just said, Clem, I think is one of the critical pieces here, is that, as we've talked about on the show before, and I forgot, and you'll remember immediately, Stephen Levin, the Supreme Court decision that allows officers to stop somebody when they see eye contact, what's that
right.
called?
It slips my mind right
yeah,
now.
But they're allowed to.
So there was right. It'll come to us. So there was a Supreme Court decision that says that if a police officer and a civilian have eye contact and that person turns and runs or walks,
right.
that the officer has a right to go after that person and stop.
Right.
Right.
Right. And that is an actual law that's on the books.
So that's allowed. So that's what we have to kind of, I think,
rethink. We have to rethink that, because, again, context, right? Are we accepting the context of what policing means to black people? Yeah. You have to accept that context before you can even dive into what you're looking at. If I see when I see the police, I do not see friendly neighbor
Mm-mm.
ready to help somebody get my cat out of a tree. I see somebody who is an occupying force in my community. So
yes.
if I do make eye contact, there is a fight or flight response, because I know what that badge and I know what that uniform means. So it has to have context provided to it. So the fact that that's even a law
mm-hmm.
Is disrespectful to the history of policing and the history of interactions with people of color and the police.
So that if anything comes out of this trial, well, let me open the phones here. If anything comes out of these trials or this trial, we'll see what happens after Goodson's trial.
Mm-hmm.
Is the discussion in Baltimore about where we take what we've learned? Right. How do we change the dynamic in this city?
Right.
And I think you see Commissioner Davis kind of being pushed into a place where he's having to wrestle with this himself. Mm-hmm. And we have to see just where, and the debates over. The power or lack of power of a civilian review board of the police
right.
to what public safety means and who the first responder should be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all those things I think are fair game now in terms of really opening a much broader discussion
right.
about where these trials take us.
Yeah, and I think community activists need to really think about what justice means and what they're actually looking for. Because I think that carceral approaches and prosecution approaches and all of these approaches are just one spoke in the wheel of how you achieve or push for social justice and a different change in communities in Baltimore.
It's really the members of the community who should decide if this is what they want. I mean, those are the victims of the crimes. And so if you live in a high crime neighborhood, you know, you want police to be there to help. I mean, that's their role. That's why the police officers were in that community mm-hmm. the day they detained and then arrested Freddie Gray, because they'd been directed, at least this is what we've heard publicly, they'd been directed by Mosby to police the high crime neighborhood, and they got there. And yes, according to the Supreme Court case, and it's the Wardlaw. According to
Thank
the Wardlaw, you're welcome. they were permitted to chase him and then detain him and ultimately pat him down and arrest him based on their belief, and it has not been proved inaccurate, based on their belief that Mr. Gray had an unlawful knife. And so the question is really for the members of the community. Do they feel better knowing that the police can help lower crime, or do they not? And That is a larger discussion.
And because to tag on to that, I think it's what Tarek was saying a moment ago, and you can jump in. I'm not speaking for you, Tarek. While the community may be worried about gangbangers on their corner, they're also worried about the police being another set of gangs.
Yes.
And they don't feel safe either way. I mean, I think that's part of the harder we have to get to. I mean, that's mm-hmm. and that which is what you were describing
that,
earlier.
You know, last year or the year before that was when Khalif Browder, the young black guy in New York, took his life.
After being
arrested illegally and sent to Rikers Island, where he spent, I believe, like 18 to 19 months of his 3-year sentence in solitary confinement.
And not charged of anything.
Not charged of anything.
I mean, no, not convicted of anything.
Not convicted of anything. Just because he was a guy who wasn't ready, like many other young men who are probably being arrested right now as we speak around the country, that wasn't prepared to do time. To know that the choice cannot be, hey, we're going to have police come from all the way up by, you know, lower Pennsylvania, you know, 83ers, as they would say. The choice cannot be between them coming in and treating this as like it's South Vietnam, or we're going to let people who want to do criminal activity all the time in your community run amok. There has to be a middle way. I think we're smart enough as a society and as a community and as a city to decide something different. So I think the toughest part of, hey, do you want your community policed or not? It's almost like the mafia. You know, it's like, hey, we want to protect your store, but you're going to have to pay us in some type of way. So it's like you're being extorted for having your community be safe. You know, and I think that's abusive in a way. And we have to start thinking about, do we need police riding around like this is an overseas war? You know, or is there a different way? So I think that's the, like you were saying, as far as, you know, Commissioner Davis, that's what he's wrestling with within himself. Is how do we do that without the business as usual approach, which is knocking heads and going crazy in neighborhoods? I'm sorry, Kalima, you look pensive.
Oh yeah, no, it's just, and I'm trying to put this in some context because I keep saying it, but I'm like, I don't know if I'm necessarily saying it the right way. I think that we need to have a broader conversation about carceral strategies and about what warrants police intervention, what warrants community conferencing. Right? What warrants a different understanding of how people receive justice? Because if we simply rely on the carceral system to provide justice in a system that was never designed to provide justice for black and brown people in the first place, was not built on that, that if we're asking the same system to provide us justice and it wasn't even designed to do that from the first place, you're never going to get it. So we need to broaden our understanding and broaden our ways of thinking about holding people accountable for doing wrongs against one another. I'm not saying that we should let people run around and shoot and deal drugs and act a fool. I grew up on West Baltimore. No, not so much. However, there are ways that we need to rethink carceral strategies as it relates to crime in neighborhoods because the system was not necessarily designed to protect those particular black and brown bodies and poor bodies in the first place.
We have to take a short break. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of people calling in, and I'm going to get to Oscar and Bill and Ernest. But I also want to talk to Stephen Levin as a former prosecutor when we come back from break. Just about, are there ways that the prosecution end of our world, state and federal, and the police, can actually merge thinking with people who are in the community about a different way of approaching this, as opposed to it being the same paradigm we've always had? Is there another way to do it in unity, in unison?
Right.
We'll explore that when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here with Kalima Young, Tarek Touré, and Stephen Levin. Stephen Levin is a former federal prosecutor, now in private practice. Tarek Touré is a poet, writer, and activist who's written the book Black Seeds, The Poetry and Reflections of Tarek Touré. Kalima Young is an instructor at Tufts University, University of Maryland College Park, getting her PhD in American Studies, is a teacher, thinker, and activist in our community as well. And you all are 410-319-8888. Let me go right to the phones. And Oscar, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Oscar, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, you know, if you put a person in the way and handcuff and shackle, that constitutes a rough ride. So people are trying to be slick and talking around this. There's no evidence. If Marlon Mosby made any mistake at all, it's not declaring all the police as hostile witnesses because they're going to lie for each other. I was a police for 25 years in Baltimore City. And you're talking about the case of you can flee, a person look at you and make eye contact and run. Well, you can go after, you can pat them down. But an arrest must be incidental to a lawful arrest. They didn't make the arrest on this boy for the knife until they searched. They searched him, then made the arrest. You can't do that. You have to have the search must be incidental to a lawful arrest. There was no lawful arrest. And only because of Judge Williams are making the rulings that he's making to make anybody say, well, this case is coming apart. It's coming apart because Williams wanted it to come apart. These police are guilty as sin, and everybody knows that. But some kind of way, well, the police have a tough job, and they're doing this, and it's coming apart. It's not coming apart. They just don't want to find these people guilty of what. And Marlon Mosby made an absolute perfect case. She charged each police for what they did or did not do, and they are guilty, but they're not going to be found guilty because that's the way the United States of America is. And we got too many black people call themselves black going along with this nonsense, and they want to make a bad case against this prosecutor. She did what prosecutors around this country won't do and should do. All six of these guys should do some time in jail. Thank you.
Thank you, Oscar. And I think the sense of what you said in terms of what she brought a case that was really important to bring was with Doug Colbert. That's the argument he makes in this program constantly. Mm-hmm. Anybody responses before we go back to the phones?
Sure. Mark, I certainly understand Oscar's frustration. You could hear the emotion in his voice. But we wouldn't want anyone convicted or acquitted based on emotion. It has to be that those are decisions that have to be made based upon the facts. And so when we hear someone say Ms. Mosby brought perfect cases, clearly she didn't. Judge Williams acquitted Officer Nero. It was obviously not a perfect case. And I think it's a disservice to Judge Williams to suggest he wanted the cases to come apart. There's no evidence that Judge Williams wants any of these cases to come apart. He seems to be a neutral and detached judge, which is what we want.
I think, though, the frustration that Oscar is talking to and the frustration that is happening is that there are too many Freddie Grays.
Absolutely.
Being stopped and frisked and arrested every day in the city.
Right.
Only because they're under suspicion because they're black on the street corner and then turn away and walk away and the police come because they don't want to be questioned by the police.
Right.
I mean, I think that's part of the heart of the problem, which you cannot get a conviction on because there's nothing illegal about it.
No, the remedy for an unlawful arrest is that a motion to suppress is granted and the case goes away. But it doesn't become a criminal conviction. You don't get a criminal conviction against a law enforcement officer because an arrest may have been bad. And maybe maybe the laws should change in that regard.
Well, one of the things I was suggesting on the show the other day, because I think it's going to take a long time to reform the police and reform anything in society. And I said, you know, I'm not remembering the name of the little boy who was shot. The 13-year-old kid who was shot in the leg?
Dedrick Colvin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dedrick Colvin, who had the toy gun that looked like a real gun, had the water pistol. And he was shot in the leg. And I was talking to the minister of the Nation of Islam here, Carlos Muhammad. And we were talking about the years when the Fruit of Islam had their own company and hired people who were members of the Nation and members who were not people not in the Nation, and they patrolled the high-rises in Baltimore. And when they patrolled the high-rises, all the numbers came in and crime went down and confrontations went down and arrests went down out of the high-rises when they were patrolling and doing security. And we were talking about what the difference would be with a response. The police sees this young man, sees him as a danger, pulls out a gun, tells him to stop. The kid panics. Kid run. Kid gets shot in the leg. And as Carlos said, if we were on the street, we'd have seen that kid. The man would have walked up to him, said, "What is that in your hand? Mm-hmm. Let me see that. What are you holding there? Why are you carrying this gun like this? Where's your mother? Let's go have a walk." And there would be a huge – that boy would never have been shot. And there would have been a different sense of what public safety could mean if first responders were actually perhaps in the community and not the police. And in terms of who patrols the community and who helps things happen.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when I hear that kind of story, and I've heard those kinds of stories a lot, the question becomes, when we can actually start looking at each other as full-fledged, complex human beings towards one another at all times, and we create an environment where everyone sees the humanity in each other as opposed to seeing each other as like imminent threats, complete otherness, dangerous otherness, then we have a shift. And in that story, what I hear in that story is people looking at a young man and seeing the full complexity of that human being. You are a human person, not necessarily a threat. You have family. You have people that look out for you. You have opinions. You have thoughts. You might be doing something a little knuckleheaded. And that's a very different approach, that if we could see each other as humans, the first responders and the folks being responded to as actual human beings in an exchange and in an interaction, then we start shifting. But as long as we have so many different cultural forces that are creating this space where the humanity of Black, brown, and poor people isn't the first thing that you see, you're going to continue having inequities that look like this.
So In response to Dedrick Coleman, I wrote, Amadou had a wallet, Trayvon had Skittles, Black boy with a BB gun might as well have a missile. So literally in my car in the parking lot of
It's good to have a poet in the house.
WEAA, right? There's a cap gun with an orange tip in the front seat of the van because I had some youth with me that went to the Keys Development Community Cookout yesterday. And, you know, I immediately took it. And it's not even a BB gun. I'm just like, look, because you pop the tip off, or even with the tip, or just the handle, you know, it doesn't even look nearly like how, you know, big a revolver will look. But I'm not even going to give them the opportunity to put themselves in that situation. But everybody doesn't have that happening. But I believe what Kalima is saying is extremely important, that before we have an altercation with Freddie Gray, before we have an altercation with Dedrick Coleman, what is placing the ability to see humanity in the communities that we're supposed to be policing and the people that are in the communities before you even go through basic training? What is happening then? And if it's not there, what are we doing in basic training to educate them on that, that you may have these implicit biases before you even go there? Also, to reflect on Michelle Alexander and her work and her writing, it makes me think about the FOI being in the high rises, which is awesome. But at the same time, we also know that there is money to be made from policing, period. The rewards, you know, police departments get and things of that nature. If we would have had the FOI running around everywhere, the budget goes down. I mean, that makes complete sense to me. You know, I'm not an accountant, but I would know that if the FOI is policing these different high-rise, these different high-crime areas, then we don't need police as much. So the money-making aspect of policing ties into that as well. So if I'm running a police department and I know there are certain benefits to be attained from this level of policing, these seizures, different things of that nature, I'm not too big on the Nation of Islam having the FOI doing the due diligence that they were engaged in, you know, at the time when they were in the high rises.
Steve, what do you think about part of the conversation? I'm curious, as somebody who, for argument's sake, let's say you were named federal prosecutor, and this idea came up as a conversation about an alternative way that we should think about policing. What would your response be?
Well, I think there are alternatives to policing. I don't know that what Tarak just described is the best way. I think certainly when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office under the leadership of Rod Rosenstein, there were several of us, and me included, who went out to the community along with community organizers, probation officers, and we would address groups of individuals who had been in trouble with the law in the past. And the purpose of meeting with them was not to tell them we were, you know, we were targeting them and that they were going to be soon to be arrested. The purpose of meeting with them was to provide with them alternatives to crime, and that if in fact they didn't change their ways, they would likely find themselves and their names on an indictment in the future. But that. That was what we were trying to avoid. So there are alternatives to simply going out and locking people up. And that's just talking to them. What Kalima said earlier, you know, seeing them as human beings, you know, inviting them to these meetings along with a loved one, a mother, a father, a sibling, someone who would hear the same message, that we weren't simply trying to get stats and get these arrests. We wanted to make the community better. By offering people alternatives.
It seems to me those two things we're talking about here are not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. I mean, to target people who we know in communities are the bad actors who are actually carrying the guns and creating violence inside the community and hurting people and threatening people's way of life and freedom, mm-hmm. is saying, okay, we know who you are, we want to talk to you, and we want you to stop this, or is not a contradiction to having safe streets or former sex workers becoming health workers in the community and working in the community, mm-hmm. or having FOI be the first line that patrols streets that have respect in community and quell the violence while you're also changing the nature of community. I mean, mm-hmm. to me, there's not a contradiction there.
And all of it costs money. You know, all it costs, you're talking about...
It's how you spend the money.
It's how you spend the money.
Invested where?
Because, you know, even with Safe Streets, you're working mm-hmm. with guys who are ex-felons who are, mm-hmm. you know, very familiar with the life that goes on, you know, in the so-called underworld of the streets. They also should be able, just like police, they should be able to make a qualified living from the work that they're doing in the community, so that is incentivized for somebody to come out of prison and go into that type of work.
So let me come back to the trial here and what we might learn from this. Let me go back to the phones first, because I promise to go back. 410-319-8888. Bill in Northeast, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Very well. Good morning.
Okay. My point is this. First of all, I think that the state attorney, Marilyn Mosby, tried to do what citizens said it's the right thing to do, and that's finally bring police up on charges, which a lot of times don't happen. And even though the system says that they promote justice, it's obvious they don't. My point is this, is that most of us, I'm saying most of us, the majority of us, saying that Freddie Gray, is obvious that his neck was broken before he got into the paddy wagon. Now, you know, it's the same way with Rodney King. Even though people witnessed it, then that's still not the charges that they want to try to kill the police. They said that the police drove the paddy wagon is responsible for his death. Did we all not see that the man can walk when they put him in the paddy wagon? You know, so I mean, you know, when people talk about the distrust within the system, then these are the type of behaviors that make people even distrust the system more. So my point is that why is it, Mark, that even your guests that you normally have, nobody wants to deal with the initial arrest of Freddie Gray, where everybody witnessed are watching them put the man into the paddy wagon that he could not walk?
Bill, you raise a point that we have talked about in this show. I mean, when Dwight Pettit was on here and other attorneys, they have the points they made was they do not understand why an alternative medical examination was not made mm-hmm. by outside parties to say when did this actually occur, that you saw on the videotape what appeared to be a Freddie Gray in physical distress mm-hmm. and in pain being put in the wagon, and that was never brought out. I mean, it's the common wisdom of people watching the tape, and just legally why that wasn't kind of advanced by the prosecutor to investigate that. Was that a possibility? Did that happen? I mean, that, I think that that is an issue that, that a lot of people have raised, which was it something happened to him before he was ever put into the van that was driven by Officer Goodson.
That isn't what the evidence suggested. Even the state's own medical examiner said the trauma occurred between the second and the fourth stops. There are a number of witnesses, both law enforcement and Dante Allen, at least initially, who said that Freddie Gray was moving around, banging, and it, the way Dante Allen described it, at least initially, and he was the other prisoner in the van, in the transport van, that that Freddie Gray was throwing himself against the sides of the van and yelling. So that evidence would, in my view, contradict the suggestion that Freddie Gray was injured prior to getting in the transport van. I've looked at that video, and frankly, it looks to me as though he's purposely trying to avoid going in the van, not that he was injured. And that's the evidence.
Kalima, you were going to say what?
Oh, gosh. Visual evidence and visual testimony is not testimony. We view and see and schematize the things that we watch through many different lenses. If we're looking for a specific thing, that's what we're going to see. If we're looking to not see someone's humanity, that's what we're not going to see. I think that as you, the caller brought up Rodney King, yeah, you can see this video and you saw exactly what happened and the visceral feeling and you know what's going on. But if people who are in charge of the prosecution that goes along with that schematizes this differently, then whatever your visual testimony is going to be, it's going to be contradicted. You know, we can be sitting in the same room experiencing the same exact thing and see it differently. And visual testimony, just because it's on tape, doesn't actually speak for folks, for everyone's experiences of how they're seeing it. As much as when I look at that tape, I'm like, his neck was already broken. Like, my visceral feeling of this is like, oh, my goodness. But at the same time, to understand our viewing practices is extremely important, and to take visual testimony as the only face value does not do justice for the way that we actually read images that we see.
I think the perfect way to juxtapose that is Eric Garner.
Right.
Because literally you have one side of the case saying he's resisting arrest. Mm-hmm. And there's another side of the case where, you know, I stand on and many other people.
Yes,
where they're saying they're choking the life out of him on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with Freddie Gray. We're seeing a young black male add context. So I always add, you have to always add context. We're seeing a young black male after having a knee driven into his spine, add context of knees being driven in spines in our community, being dragged, so to say, or carried, you know, after all of that happening and him basically dangling with his leg, not even, you know, just his leg was also injured as well, and pretty much like he's being carted off the field into this police van. So like Kalima was saying, you can see, we're all going to see what we are conditioned to see.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of which that we've been seeing things in our life.
Yes.
But I know that in many of these communities around the United States that what happened to Freddie Gray isn't out of the norm. It's normal to see young black men and women mm-hmm. be injured and all of that and then placed in police vans. So
let me jump back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Teddy in South Baltimore, you're on the air. On five. Hi, good morning.
You know, this system is really, really wrong because they're talking out both sides of their mouth. Now, if they did not find those police officers guilty of something, why would they pay this man all of this money for a settlement? Then on the other side, they're going to get some shyster lawyers to defend their case. And may I ask a personal question? Maybe you can't answer. Who is paying for these police officers' lawyers? Is the system paying for this, or do they pay out of their pocket?
That's a good question.
With the Fraternal Order of Police.
That's what I thought, the FOP, right.
Yes.
Yeah, they're, it's a union that represents them that are paying for their attorneys. And I think what you said earlier as well, I mean, I think that Yeah, I think that is it. Yeah, it was that's who paid there. The FOP always stands up to do that. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think that it raised this to me. I'm really interested in our response to all this when it's done. What's going to happen when these convictions happen or do not happen? And I'm really more interested in how we reform what happens for the future. I want to see justice done. I'm not saying that. I want to see justice done, but I'm really more interested in seeing how we change the future, how we have a world where we don't have Freddie Gray's, who was arrested, whatever those numbers were, 18 times or 19 times, 21 times, whatever the number was, only convicted once, but arrested all those other times. And that where that kind of world doesn't exist. But we have a different sense of what justice means.
I think we have to look at justice as a continuum and not just a moment. That's the biggest part. And if we're caught up in the moment of trying to get justice for Freddie Gray, then we'll lose what this is all about. And this is just about bettering the conditions of people who are dispossessed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's ultimately what is, if you think about his neighborhood, if you think about all the arrests that you just discussed, if you think about all of that, You build a picture of somebody who already had the law against them. They already had, Freddie Gray already had the cards stacked against them before that day even happened. It's almost anybody who's gone through that many arrests, it's almost inevitable that they'll come in contact with the justice system in some form or fashion. Anyway, it just happened at this particular time on this particular day. It resulted in his death some days later. And I think us, you know, people who care about these situations, it's about building things that are productive and proactive so that these situations don't happen. You know, I if we get caught up in a moment and if it's just about this, we might as well just stay in our houses and never come out again, because right. it'll be disrespectful. You know, to the family of Freddie Gray and the people who are living in those situations.
It's one of my favorite Nelson Mandela quotes. It's like, when the water is boiling, it's foolish to take it off the heat. Right? So this is a moment, right? It was a moment in April 2015. It's a moment, the water is boiling. And if we take it off the heat, if we only focus on this particular space, then we're going to lose the momentum of pushing the conversation about justice, inequity, the humanity of Black people. We're going to push that conversation away. So we have to put it within the whole context of a social justice movement, that we're going to continually keep the water boiling. When injustices arise, we keep the water boiling. We keep bringing it up. We keep having an analysis. We keep providing alternatives. We keep thinking about the structures that are making the inequalities happen.
And Mark, if I may, I think it's always the right time to talk about reform. And you've raised, and your guests have raised, the idea of reform in terms of policing. But I think what we have seen, at least what we saw in the last few days of this trial, perhaps there should be reform within the criminal justice system as far as it goes to the prosecution's case. And what we have seen, what we saw last week, were constant discovery violations. Fortunately, Officer Goodson and the other lawyers representing the other officers were very experienced, very good. I beg to differ with the description of a shyster lawyer. I'm not quite sure what that even means. Mm-hmm. But in this case, all the officers have excellent legal representation, and we would want anybody charged with a crime in Baltimore City or elsewhere to have excellent legal representation, whether appointed or retained. And but for that excellent legal representation, we may not have discovered that the prosecution failed to turn over evidence. And I'm sure it's not the only time. We've heard from many defense attorneys. I'm a defense attorney. There are, unfortunately, always cases where the prosecution, either because of the poor relations with the police or because they're afraid to lose a case, they don't turn over discovery. And I think one of the reforms should also address the prosecutor's responsibilities for turning over what's called Brady material. And some efforts have been made, but that is significant. We could have gone through this trial And Officer Goodson may still be convicted, but he may have been convicted based on evidence that was not turned over. And that's outrageous.
Now that is outrageous. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was sloppy prosecutorial work not to release the evidence to the defense attorney.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was really shocked by that.
There's no excuse for a case with this much attention,
high profile case like this.
being prosecuted by the two senior ranking state's attorneys in that office. There's simply no excuse. And I think Judge Williams was being generous when he suggested that it wasn't nefarious. It was just that the deputy state's attorney didn't recognize it to be Brady material. Or
he thought he was being kind.
Yeah, I thought he was being kind. because I don't know how you have experienced prosecutors who don't recognize Brady material for what it is.
So the time we have left, what do we have? Like we got time for another caller or two. Maybe let's try to get in here. 410-319-8888. Some closing thoughts from our guests before we move on to a new topic for the next hour. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Ernest. You're on the air.
Evening.
Hey, Ernest.
I was on the police department more than 25 years. I drove the wagon for 15 years. When I started driving, all kinds of weather, storms, 6 inches of snowstorms. I had to transport prisoners all over the city and some places in the county. Never had an incident like that. If you take a prisoner and don't put him on the bench and handcuff him and hog tie him and put him on a stomach in the wagon, that's a rough ride. Now, he locked him up. He locked Freddie Gray up. When they locked him up, they said that he was healthy. When he got out of the wagon, he had a broken spine, 3 broken vertebrae, a crushed voice box. That's in evidence. So what are you supposed to do? Just let a person go? Now, the wagon man is responsible for a lot of that. When they say he was jumping around the wagon and stuff like that, he should have called it to stop and get that lieutenant over here that was in the initial arrest and say, get your men in there and put him in the seat and seatbelt him because he's going to injure himself. No, this wagon man is responding to 10-15 calls. A 10-15 is when a police is in trouble. Not a 13. Well, we need the wagon immediately. That means he was hitting on the gas and going fast. He wasn't driving slow. You don't do that. Now, why is it that when you lock him up, why didn't he take him straight to men's detention? Straight. Not riding around 4 or 5 stops. He was arrested. He's supposed to go straight to men's detention. He doesn't have to respond to no other wagon. They got wagons in each district that will respond out of their district. In most cases, they have 2 wagons in the district. See, but the reason why this show is off, these people that's talking.
I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. I realize we're so up against the clock. We have no time for closing thoughts, or yes, no? Yes, no? I apologize. I didn't realize I was looking at the wrong message here on my computer. It says my fault for not managing that time right. I apologize to all of you. I want to thank our guest here, Stephen Levine, who is a former federal prosecutor and partner in Levine and Curlett. Good to have you here. I hope you come back. It was good
thank
to have
you
in the studio.
Thanks.
Tarek Touré, who's going to be staying with us for the next conversation, along with Kalima Young. Thank you both for being here. This conversation, we move to Orlando and its complexity. Stay with us. Don't go away.